what we bring is really a deeper understanding of auto-awareness behavior. Now, why don't people do what is so logical? Why is so rational? Why do they sabotage themselves? Why are executives so self-destructive? Why do they suffer from hubris? Why do most executive teams don't work very well? What are the dynamics going on in the group?
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This is a podcast in which we will discover the world of psychoanalysis that lives beyond the couch, beyond the individual consultation room. We will meet psychoanalysts who work in dialysis units, prenatal clinics, corporate boardrooms, community centers, humanitarian organizations, and with vineyard workers, just to name a few. We hope these conversations expand our awareness of how broadly psychoanalytic thinking extends into our communities. Come listen, enjoy, and please share your comments on the webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org.
Welcome, everyone, to today's podcast. I am Dr. Stephen Rolfe. I'm an analyst on the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Center of Philadelphia and chair of the American Psychoanalytic Association's Committee on Corporate and Organizational Consulting. I am managing principal of Rolfe Advisory and Sante Advisory and specialize in psychodynamic leadership advisory services for CEOs, business owners, and leaders in crisis. Our guest today is Manfred Ketz de Vries. Manfred is Distinguished Clinical Professor of Leadership Development and Organizational Change and Raoul de Vitré Davenport, Chair Professor of Leadership Development Emeritus at INSEAD. He brings a different view to the much-needed studied subjects of leadership and the dynamics of individual and organizational change. Bringing to bear his knowledge of and experience of economics, management, and psychoanalysis, he scrutinizes the interface between international management, psychoanalysis, psychotherapy, and dynamic psychiatry. Manfred directs the Challenge of Leadership Executive Program at INSEAD and is the founder of INSEAD's Global Leadership Center. The Financial Times, Le Capital, and The Economist rated Manfred Ketz de Vries as one of the world's top 50 leading management thinkers, as well as one of the most influential contributors to human resource management. He is the author and co-author editor of 49 books and has published over 400 papers as articles or chapters in books. His books and articles have been translated into 31 languages. The interviewee's statements about today's political leaders reflect his own views and not those of this podcast nor of the IPA. Manfred, welcome to our podcast. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm very excited to hear what you have to tell us about your current work in leadership. But I thought we could start by my asking you how your initial interest in leadership and working with leaders came about. And I wondered specifically whether this predated your interest in analysis.
Actually, that's quite true. You know, I am a product of, I'm born in the Second World War, and I'm born in Holland, and it was a very difficult time in the country. You know, in the house of my grandfather, there were 13 people hiding. And so my mother was quite active during that time, also my father, actually. The main issue was at the time to, of course, obtain food for those people. And so after the war, when I was somewhat bigger, and I was overwhelmed actually with stories about what happened. And so I got quite interested in dysfunctional leaders. And of course, the major ones at the time were three, which was Hitler, Stalin, and Mao. And so that was my original interest. And that has stayed with me to some extent that, what can be done about the rot at the top? And how does it affect organizations and societies at large? As you can see, actually, very much happening in the world at the moment, led actually by a leader in your country, which is very, very unfortunate. I'm just going sideways, but I remember, I think it was 1957 when a book came out called The Ugly American. And at the time, Kennedy was a senator, and he got so excited about it, and he gave the book to all the other senators. And I guess one of the results of it was also, I think, the Peace Corps and organizations like that to try to make the world a better place. And it is remarkable how, in such a short time, a leader or the leader of your country has become such a terrible role model and encouraged so many other leaders. I mean, if America would be a banana republic, but it isn't. And it is also, I mean, I spent quite a few years in America, and it was a very important time. And seeing what's happening now is quite, it's more than disappointing, I must say. And of course, also the element of, the values, the culture the country stands for, the melting pot it stands for. And now what's happening is, this whole issue, we already have enough identity politics in Europe. And we have seen the result of that in the Second World War, to say the least. Anyway, I don't want to go too much in that. It's such a terrible role model for my children, grandchildren, either personal and the world at large.
Well, I definitely want to return to this topic later in our conversation. But if we could return for a minute, I wanted to just get a sense from you about your initial interest in analysis, in psychoanalysis, and hear a little bit about your training and how that affected your interest in leadership.
I always say I combine the dismal science with the impossible profession. The dismal science, of course, being Keynes' description of economics, and the impossible profession, Freud's description of psychoanalysis. Anyhow, when I studied in Holland, when I was 17 years old, I went to the Harvard Summer School, and it made an enormous impression on me because, from a fairly local individual, I suddenly was exposed to people from many different cultures, and it really had an enormous impact on me, to me at that young age. And I decided I want to come back there. That was one of the things I decided. Anyhow, I did a doctoral examination in Holland economics, which was probably a reason of probably influenced by my father. And then I went to America. I got accepted in the funny program at the Harvard Business School called the International Teachers Program, which at the time was a program to convert the natives to the case method. But when I was asked for some advice about different programs, different courses, my advisor said, why don't you take this funny course by a man called Abraham Selesnik called Psychoanalytic Psychology and Management Theory. So I said, sounds interesting. I had always had an interest in psychology, even though I was studying economics. And I remember the first reading, I still remember that the first reading was Jung's biography of Freud. And it was, it's an enormous book, and it was the first assignment. So my English was not so glorious, so I spent a week reading that book, did nothing else reading that book. And of course, when I came to the seminar, it turns out I was the only one who read the book, which was kind of... But anyhow, Selesnik made quite an impact on me because in a way, he wanted to bring the person back into the organization. He was in kind of a strange animal at the Harvard Business School. He had split off from the organizational behavior department. They got into it. Psychoanalysts like splitting, so, and particularly in France, they like splitting. But he split too. And so that got me interested in psychoanalysis, and I became an assistant. And I also took some courses from Erik Erikson, who was there. I met him. He was at the university. And I decided it would be very useful if I wanted to explore more my work in organizations to become a psychoanalyst, which was, of course, not that easy, particularly when you were in America, because I was not a medical doctor. Anyhow, there's a lot of other things in between. I was hoping at the time to get an appointment at the Harvard Business School, but to be the disciple of Selesnik was like having a black stamp on your forehead. So the OB department was quite hostile for, you don't have to, they were not for it. So I eventually went back to France, got an appointment at INSEAD, which is one of the better schools in management in the world, I guess. And I started analysis with a woman called Joyce McDougall, who was quite well known. She wrote quite a bit about theaters of the body, theaters of the mind, and things like that. An interesting lady who actually came from New Zealand. But eventually I decided to go back to North America. And after an intermission at Harvard as a research fellow, I went to McGill, where you had an interesting person, Henry Mintzberg, who is quite well known in management theory, who was crazy enough to hire me. And that also gave me an opportunity to apply to the Canadian Psychoanalytic Society as a candidate. And I did my, it's a long story how it all worked. Again, psychoanalysts can be quite strange sometimes, but I ended up having a second analyst, which was a man called Maurice Doncier. He was the head of the Allen Memorial Institute and head of psychiatry, and which I, in my naivety, I was not really a politician, otherwise I would have an appointment at the Harvard Business School, I think. I realized later that he was quite powerful in the system as the head of psychiatry, the head of the major mental health institute in Canada. So my training went quite smoothly. It went quite fast. I went through the program. I had also an interesting supervisor called Clifford Scott. I don't know if you ever heard of him, but he was one of the oldies of psychoanalysis. He was an associate editor of the International Journal, analyzed by Melanie Klein. Quite interesting person who had a great opportunity to put me in knots all the time. Every time I came from a supervisory session, I was completely confused. And he also had another habit. He liked his supervisees. So all the other ones I had, they let me go, but not him.
Put you in knots in what sense?
No, I mean, his fairly complex Kleinian interpretations. And I mean a Dutch boer, you know, fairly low complex culture, was sometimes difficult to reconcile. But I can tell you, I mean, it's actually the anecdote. Why did I pick him? At the Allen Memorial Institute at the time, they had the patient of the week. There was a very interesting seminar where on the closed circuit television, an analyst would interview a patient. Then there were two other analysts. They would discuss the patient, and there was the audience were the people who were treating the patient and other and students and whatever. So I would follow that. And one day it was Clifford Scott who was interviewing the patient. And I, after seeing that, said, "My God, what's going on there?" I rushed off to the couch and lay on the couch and start to complain to my analyst, Donger. He said, "You know, what the hell is he doing?" And Donger said, "Give him a second chance. Just wait." And I guess your analyst can have quite an influence on you. So I said, there must be something there. So I picked him as my first supervisor. And it was interesting. The other supervisors were more straightforward, typical, you know, trying quite not so complicated. But Clifford Scott was a very different ballgame. So he had quite an influence on me. I remember his last session. The last session, he finally let me go. That's the word. He put me in his own chair. He had this deep kind of very deep fauteuil type of chair. He put a chair in front of a big mirror, that put me in the chair and sat behind the chair and let me talk about my patient. By the way, my first patient was an entrepreneur.
Right. That's the one you had written about.
Yes.
Unbelievable. Yes.
Nobody wanted him, by the way. It was, I mean, nobody wanted him. He was too complicated. So I got.
Did they think he wasn't analyzable?
Yeah, I don't know what they want, but you know, I mean, as a candidate, you look desperately, and I was not in the circuit. I was out of it. I was not working in a hospital. I was working as a professor at McGill in management.
Yes.
So I was a compassionate offer by one of the analysts that why don't you do something with him, and it turned out very interesting. It was a very interesting case. Taught me a lot about entrepreneurship. You have to remember also that I come from an entrepreneurial family. So my father is an entrepreneur. My brothers are entrepreneurs. So it's I'm also somewhat of an educational entrepreneur.
Yes.
So it was a combination. I also had at the time when I was at Harvard Business School, there was another person I met who is now a training analyst in India. Sudhir Kakaru became one of my best friends, if not my best friend. And he was writing a book on Frederick Taylor. Encouraged by, so he was a research fellow for Ericsson. So that's the way I also met Ericsson. This was kind of an interesting, intense learning experience when I was there.
That's quite a combination, right? Frederick Taylor and Ericsson.
Yes. Ericsson was at the time writing his book on Gandhi. And he met actually Sudhir when he was in Ahmedabad. So he offered him Sudhir's interest in psychoanalysis too. And so he had quite an influence. And later on, when I started to work at INSEAD and started my, what I sometimes call facetiously, my CEO recycling seminar, he became my partner in this. And in that CEO recycling, that's called the challenge of leadership, developing your intelligence.
Yes. Maybe you should say some about that, Manfred, about that seminar.
When I initially of course, as a professor of management of organizational behavior, I taught the core course, taught some electives. Then I started to teach more esoteric things like psychoanalytic psychology and management, which I did at McGill for a number of years. Then I decided to go back to Europe because I guess in a way Montreal is a little bit of a dead place, to be honest, after the language battle. And INSEAD was really starting to boom and more interesting because of its kind of student body and also eventually the whole issue of having a campus in Singapore and later on was in Abu Dhabi, etc., a more interesting place. So I taught for a while the core course OB, organizational behavior at INSEAD, which I did quite well. But then I decided it became too much mass production work. You know, you have this number of sections and you deal with that and you give some kind of show. So I decided why don't I do a selected seminar for senior executives, which I started, I must say, it's the longest running seminar at our school. And I'm the dinosaur. It has been running now for 28 years. That's a long time. But it has been the laboratory for lots of important things, applying psychoanalytic knowledge to management. I had to make a choice. I mean, if I would have stayed in Montreal, I might have just have become somewhat of a traditional psychoanalyst and see a number of patients. But how many patients does a psychoanalyst see in his lifetime? And what I'm trying was, I thought maybe I can expand it. So I started off with, and coming back to my original interest, because of the war trauma of my mother particularly, and my father didn't talk about it very much because he lost quite a few family members in the World War, and whole part of the family, they all ended up in the well-known concentration camps. So I think one of the meta issues for me is, what can I do to create best places to work? I sometimes call it ausentisotic organizations, which comes from two Greek words, ausentikos and zotikos. Basically, you know, where people feel well. And of course, that's an utopia, but you can at least strive for it. And most organizations, the majority of organizations, are somewhat of like gulags. And it puzzled me that psychoanalysts spent a lot of time with creative artists and people like that, but the world of work was quite ignored. So I got quite involved in the movement of trying to use psychoanalytic concept into organizations. And I was one of the founding members of ISPSO, the International Society for the Psychoanalytic Study of Organizations, which has been doing quite well.
I want to return for a minute, though, Manfred. First of all, it sounds like you really took to psychoanalysis and psychoanalytic training and psychoanalytic understanding almost immediately from that very early time with Abe Zalesnik.
Yes, I Abe at the time was quite impressive. It wasn't a certain amount of idealizing transference for a while, but we all have clay feet. I would have my weekly meeting with him, and we talked about things. I got involved in quite an intense research project on stress, and I wrote cases for him. And so I kept on following his seminar, which was a very interesting seminar. The people he collected to be participate in the seminar were quite interesting, or different, which I actually imitated a little bit like that when I was at McGill, where I started a postdoctoral and professorial seminar, also focused on psychoanalysis for faculty members and some doctoral students. So that was a very, very interesting learning experience. But I was trying to transmit, and I come back to my CEO recycling seminar, that became actually an eye-opener, because to take 20, 21 executives, senior executives, and put them in one big group, and try to get the best out of them and try to help them to be more effective leaders and maybe more reflective leaders was quite a challenge, because originally the seminar was 3 weeks long. I made it now 4 weeks long. So basically it is three iterations of 4.5 days, January, March, May. And now I added also one in December, which is actually in Singapore, to see if they can walk on their own feet. But what it did was that it got me interested in doing something more, because, you know, this is a very selected group of people, which are quite senior executives. But a lot of people were interested in using psychoanalytic concepts in organizations. And that brought me, and was actually, again, in some kind of lucky combination of factors, that I started this program. It's now called the Executive Masters in Change Management. It has changed the name. which I started to do together with two younger analysts, both psychoanalysts, one from Holland and one from an American who was trained in Frankfurt. And that became a very successful, think about it, a business school, having a mastery program which is run by three psychoanalysts and very psychoanalytic oriented over a period of 2 years. And through that process, I was saying that, to expand the psychoanalytic knowledge to a larger public, probably not the pure goal of psychoanalysis, we can talk about that, but I sometimes get excited about that because sometimes it's like bold men fighting for a comb. And they don't like when I say that. I got once an award in Holland from the Dutch Psychoanalytic Society, the Freud Penning, and I made this comment, and there was a very ambivalent response to my presentation that I was telling them, listen, a big part of the world, you don't pay attention to the world of work. That's where people spend a lot of time. You pay attention to some creative artists, but the world of work, nothing. And there you can really make an impact. In the meantime, many other people fill in this gap and not so great.
But I'd like you to speak to what psychoanalyst really brings to this world of work and this world of organizations.
I think one of the things, of course, is I started off by why did Selesnik at the time split from the OB department at the Harvard Business School? It had to do that they were more fascinated about structures and systems, which is much easier to deal with than people, because people are unpredictable. What we bring is really a deeper understanding of auto-awareness behavior. Now, why don't people do what is so logical? Why is it so rational? Why do they sabotage themselves? Why are executives so self-destructive? Why do they suffer from hubris? Why do most executive teams don't work very well? What are the dynamics going on in the group? And why have so many organizations a gulag culture? And what are kind of social defenses are taking place there? In that respect, I'm influenced by some of the work of Elliot Shakes and Menzies, who I think made some interesting contributions about that. Like the snake under the carpet syndrome. You see a bump at the carpet, you straighten out the carpet and it looks all right. They go away and the bump is back. So you have to go beyond symptom suppression. You have to see what the hell is going on and look at the dynamics, and which become, by the way, extremely important, and psychology and psychoanalytic concept become extremely important in the context of family business, where I wrote two books on family business. And there, a psychoanalyst can really make a difference to really understand what's going on, what is going on, why is it always the same problem of sibling rivalry and the succession dramas being usually father and son. Daughters do somewhat better. And there, again, just the traditional OB is not going to give you the answer.
And you have introduced this idea of the clinical paradigm in your work. And I think you might be useful for the audience to hear, exactly what you mean by that in terms of your approach, because it really does differentiate from what you refer to as the parade of coaches.
Now, basically, it's also, of course, a little bit of renaming things. I think when you would, traditionally, if you would go to a business and say you're a psychoanalyst, there's, thanks to Hollywood, is too much stereotyping of a man with a Viennese accent. I have an accent, whatever language I speak. A Viennese accent is a beard. I don't have a beard. And, and some people lying on a couch and things like that, those associations. Now, as you know, the Harvard Business School still prides itself because the case method. But the case method, I've written myself in more than 100 cases or so, but it's somewhat superficial. So when you talk about the clinical method, clini means at the bedside, actually it's the case method square. You are really involved that's the reason. But the clinical method is really, you can also call it the psychodynamic systemic orientation, that you have to take care of the environment, that if you deal with a family business, you better have a good idea about all the people in the soap opera. I'm involved at the moment in three family business cases, and he may call it wild analysis, but it's better than just doing the traditional work and coming and falling on your face. And so it's psychodynamic systemic. So I call it the clinical method, but it's basically, there is such thing as the unconscious. We have defensive systems. There's transferential processes. You have to look at the history. The past may have quite an impact on how the person will behave in the future. The traditional things, emotions are important. That's all part of that package. And I keep on repeating it. because it's important to take those some subtle signals into consideration. Coming back, for example, to these executive masters, we have now four sections on two continents. So every year, I'm not really involved anymore, but every year there are something like 200 students who are being trained. And interestingly enough, when you think about the Far East and places like that, there has been a great interest in those matters, which was in the past not the case. They were much more structure and design. And even consulting firms, I mean, I did a lot of work with the world's premier consulting firm. I think I have put some of my DNA on their intervention methods because I dealt with, at the time, for a number of years, with half the directors of that global consulting firm. So without many psychoanalysts realizing it, there is quite, the psychoanalytic thought has quite an impact in management at this point in time. Much more than was the case when I started, when I said, you know, what I'm doing, I remember telling it to my wife, you know, nobody cares, it's not very important, but it has changed.
It has changed a great deal, and it's changed largely, or to a great measure, because of your work, obviously. If I could shift for a minute, one of the things I really, and maybe to return to what you started this interview with, one of the concepts that you've spoken about and written extensively about that really speaks to me is this whole idea of the shadow side of leadership and how and why leaders become so destructive. I don't think the leadership world, maybe with you as an exception in the recent work that you've done, for example, in the book Down the Rabbit Hole of Leadership, there hasn't been too much stress in the leadership world talking about the leadership problems that we face really in America, but across the world. But I'd like you to say something about the dynamics of how and why leaders become destructive and how this dynamic of the abuse of power really is created and becomes, you know, perpetuated by the followers, that cycle that you describe.
It's kind of funny because I spent my early work, and I remember the work, one of the books I wrote was The Neurotic Organization with Danny Miller at the time, which really looking at the relationship between personality, leadership style, the kind of decision making, the kind of organization they designed, and the decision making that took place in these organizations. And I had this kind of quote unquote ideal types. I was trying to construct certain types. And so I spent many, many years looking at the pathology of leadership. I still do it to some extent, but that was really a major focus. Then I was asked by the dean at the time at INSEAD to set up a leadership center. And suddenly I had to shift gear. I had to make, because the people who come, most of them are quite successful, to make them even more successful. So it was kind of, I had to put another hat. So I was the president of the organization, talking about everything go wrong. And then I'd say, okay, this is what you can do. But of course, I wrote quite a few books about the pathology of power and the kind of, you know, destructive cycle leaders and followers get into, and almost like a cult-like phenomena, you know, ideas from social psychology, like groupthink, come into place, which you can see, by the way, in America. I mean, the Trump group, whatever he does, if he rapes a person on the front lawn of the White House, I mean, the people will still cheer him on. It's a cult. They will, you can say anything. It's and it's very scary because if you look at the movie of Leni Riefenstahl of this meeting in Nuremberg, of Deutschland erwacht, you know, many of the terms actually that Trump uses come from Hitler, Stalin, and Mussolini. I mean, it is scary. And we are such a herd animal that we say, the human being, and you can also take some explanations from neuroscience with mirroring neurons if you want to go another direction. But it's scary. I couldn't believe that Trump would be elected when he was elected. And it's this slow, incremental kind of, how he is able to bring out the darker side of people. I once wrote a book called, Shaka Zulu, Leadership by Terror, Finding Shaka Zulu in the Attic, and in which I make the argument that it doesn't take that much for the human being to show its darker side. And one has to all the time do some self-reflection and be able to stand your place when so much pressure is put onto you. And when you look at the Trump cult, it's scary. As I said, you're not a banana republic in America, and so it has become such a bad example for the rest of the world. It makes for a certain amount of, Europeans look at this whole thing, and most Europeans with amazement. Of course, in Europe, you have also a man called Boris, who is a narcissist by himself. The only thing he cares about is Boris. And also is a man very good in magical thinking. You know, the kind of the snake oil salesman. People like, it's always this wish to believe. The wish to believe in magic. And you have this idealizing transference. So people don't want to see the reality anymore. And also this, of course, the scare. I mean, if you would stand up to Trump, you get a tweet. And what might happen? You know, there's also the scariness of it all. But it's a parallel, I find, being a product of the Second World War and looking at these movies of Leni Riefenstahl and the kind of meetings you see of Trump. It's scary.
You think about the followers, and I'm talking about the Senate, for example, as it being politically expedient, or do you think there's an underlying psychological dynamic there?
It can be. It's very hard to split that out. You have to go by case by case. There is, of course, political expediency. I mean, here is a man who gets certain things through, which they otherwise wouldn't get through, and they go along. But after a while, you know, you get this identification with the aggressor syndrome. You start to how do you morally, human beings are masters in rationalization, so you start to rationalize things. Otherwise, how can you live with yourself? You should resign. As a Republican senator, I feel, looking what has been happening, and also some of those religious leaders, I mean, they should resign. But they don't. They don't. And that's partly expediency. But then after a while, you start to, the identification with the aggressor syndrome. And you start to, this is the normal way of doing things nowadays. And, and nobody really is able to say stop.
Yeah. Well, in a lot of your writings, you talk about the danger of hubris.
No, exactly. I mean, also political leaders know exactly how you manage Trump. You have to tell him all the time he's the greatest. And of course, you can say, what is his background? What is he so insecure about? Why does he need all this kind of continuous gratification, this applause? What is going on there? What was the family like? What was it like? What is his father like? Why is he such an admirer of military? What's going on there also? You make some assumptions. And then also this paranoia. You cannot trust anybody. So and you only want to feel alive when you fight people. That's the way you feel alive. I mean, I hate classification in a way, although I do it regularly. Malignant narcissist, that's what he is. It's a tragic thing that you have a relatively, not very healthy individual as the leader of the country. No, we're not saying that there were not predecessors of, you can argue when anybody wants to be a politician. You can wonder about, you can say, okay, this movie goes to Hollywood, not Hollywood, goes to Washington, there's the old movie, I'm trying to remember. So an honest man goes to Washington to...
Mr. Smith goes to Washington.
Yeah, that's right. That's the movie. So he was an honorable man, but there are quite a few who have some problems with they may be too full of their own narcissistic disposition. So anybody who wants to really be a politician, you should look at it very carefully. What is going on? Why are they doing it? And of course, again, we are masters in rationalization.
If I could just return, Manfred, for maybe we could close our interview with your saying something to the psychoanalysts who are listening to this podcast about what you feel that analysts really can bring that distinguishes them, what they can bring to this kind of understanding of leaders and understanding of organizations. Because I do think that more and more, and I can tell from doing these podcasts, that more and more analysts are interested in applications of analysis off the couch, and specifically in terms of working with organizations. And you see many different kinds of people, many different kinds of consultants who do work with organizations. So I'd just like to, like I said, maybe close on hearing a bit more about what you see analysts really bringing.
Now, I guess the first thing is that the old statement about listening with the third ear, very deep listening to really what's going on, don't taking things at face value, to really try to figure out why a person is doing and saying what he or she is saying. And that's a very important dimension. Now, the typical analytic setting is dyadic. And they have to realize there is not, that of course is, we always have the question of boundary management, but it does help to have a good idea about the system. As I was mentioning before, if you deal with a CEO of a family business, to have an understanding of the whole system will help you to at least to ask the person good questions. When I put on my professorial hat, I always have the tendency to give advice, but I have to control myself. It's better that they come up with themselves. So how to guide them in that direction and to find the solutions for themselves. I think it was Thales of Miletus, which was lived something like 600 years before, 600 years before Christ, was asked what's the most difficult thing in the world. He said, know thyself. And then he was, I think, asked also what's the easiest thing in the world, give advice. I think analysts are trained to really help people to become reflective leaders. I had one of my students who said, I always fell in love with narcissistic women. But one thing I've learned, I don't marry them any longer. That's what I mean, a reflective leader. Don't fall into repetition, compulsion, other things. That you find other way of doing things. And leaders of organizations have so much power. They can do so much harm. So if they become more reflective leader, you get better places to work. And that, I think, it's a logical thing for psychoanalysts to do it. And let's face it, in the society we have nowadays, there are very few pure psychoanalytic patients. That we have to find other ways because of the way society is developing. Maybe now you can have your patient on the couch through Skype or whatever it might be. You have to find other ways to disseminate your knowledge to a wider audience. And I think there's so much to be done there.
Well, Manfred, I really want to thank you for this interview and for speaking with us. I know you started out this podcast by saying to me that people's attention spans are only about 20 minutes, but I think you will disprove everyone on the basis of this interview. Thank you again, and it's so nice to speak with you and to be able to have this opportunity.
That was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.